Welcome to the Advisory Accelerator Podcast, designed to help CPAs who serve clients interested in non-traditional services. If you're a public accountant looking to drive more value into existing client relationships, then tune in for tips on accelerating your advisory service offerings. Now, here's your host, Jeff Paulo.
Well, hello again, everybody. This is Jeff Paulo, and I'm the president of the Engineered Advisory family of companies and your host for the Advisory Accelerator podcast, a show that works to help CPAs become more advisory-minded in their practices. On today's show, I'm happy to welcome my friend David Spray. He's the president of Export Advisors. He's also the author of Is IC Disc Right for Me? And the host of the IC Disc Show podcast. David, welcome to the show. We've got lots to talk about today.
Thank you, Jeff. Happy to be on.
You know, as we work with our CPA firm clients, there's a bit of a conundrum. It's interesting because major tax reform used to happen once in a generation, every 12 to 15, even 20 years. And now with the polarization in our political system, we're seeing that change as frequently as every 2 years election cycle. And as a result, CPAs are struggling just to keep their head above water. I know that you were a CPA, so you've got an understanding of the environment. But every time we talk with an accounting firm, they just tell us how busy they are. And as well-intended as they are in terms of being more advisory-oriented with their clients, oftentimes they're just not finding the time to be able to do that. And so one of the things we're trying to do with this podcast is to connect the dots between that mainline practitioner, partner, manager in an accounting firm and a stable of providers that are expert in their unique field of technical expertise. And when one of the clients of the CPA firm has a need for the service, give them somebody that they're confident reaching out to connect the dots and fulfill that advisory role that oftentimes they're too busy to play themselves. So with that, welcome to the show. I'm excited to talk to you because many of our CPAs deal with clients that are in the international business. They're importing and exporting. And I know IC Disc plays a big role in that. Before we jump into your deliverable, why don't you give us a little bit about your background and education?
Sure. So I believe I was born one state north of you in Iowa. And grew up in Northwest Iowa. We moved to Texas when I was a teenager. And then I went to college at the University of Texas at Austin, where I received an accounting degree, went to work for Arthur Andersen right here in Houston. And Enron was my primary client. Fortunately, I left public account or left Arthur Andersen in about 1989 or 90. So it was well before the subpoenas started flying. So that was how it got started. And then I've always had, my career has always been split between sales and marketing and finance and accounting. So after I left Andersen, I served as the CFO of a privately held entertainment company in Houston and have done a variety of other consulting type related endeavors in a business development capacity. And then I was working for a local CPA firm about 20 years ago and came to know of a research and development tax credit firm in Houston. There was a boutique firm that I joined in a business development capacity. And then they started dabbling in the export incentives, which included IC Disc. And then the firm kind of wrapped up operations about 15 years ago. And at that point, I launched Export Advisors. So it's been about, that was about 15 years ago.
I remember you telling me you started that in 2006. So you've been around for a while now. It's amazing to me, and we work closely with our CPA firm clients, that I think there's broad level understanding that IC Disc applies international situation from an export standpoint. But I'm shocked by how many people struggle to articulate what it really is. So maybe we start with that. If I'm a partner or manager in an accounting firm and just know enough to be dangerous, let's start with a little bit of an education about where it makes sense, what it is, and let's not assume that we're starting with any preconceived knowledge.
Okay, sure. Let me take a shot at that. The IC disc is a subset of what I would call export tax incentives. And most export tax incentives, quite frankly, are protectionistic. And as a result, these programs come and go. There was a program online in the early 2000s called the Extraterritorial Income Exclusion that I think in the first year, Boeing saved like $2 billion in taxes. And then Airbus got wind of that. And then the WTO was notified. And then that program went away. And so these programs through the years have come and gone. But the DISC has managed to be relevant since its inception in 1971. And the main reason it has been durable is it's really most appropriate for privately held, closely held US-based companies. The Fortune 500s, they typically don't use this. So as a result, it flies beneath the radar screen. Nobody's going to be picketing outside somebody's office because they have an IC DISC. And in fact, there's no public record even that a company has an IC DISC. The only way anybody knows is because the IC DISC tax return is filed. But it is at the simplest level, the IC DISC effectively lets a company segregate their income between domestic and export. And the export piece is taxed at the dividend tax rate, the dividend slash capital gains rate, as opposed to the ordinary tax rate. So that differential is what creates the tax savings.
So walk us through the logistics of that. I'm a business that's conducting operations. I am doing export activity. Do I need to come in and do an analysis? Is this something I can pull off of my P&L? What level of work do I need to go through in order to make sure that I've got this segmented correctly?
Yeah, that's a great question. Before I get to that, would you mind if I took a slight detour?
Not at all.
I'm a numbers guy. Most CPAs are. So let me give you kind of some stats that will give my answer better context. So we find that only about one out of 200 US companies are candidates for the IC DISC. So the first thing to realize is that's one of the reasons it's so underutilized is there's just so few of them. So if you think of a large local CPA firm that has a robust corporate advisory practice, and let's say they have 200 good-sized corporate clients, statistically, only one of those would be a candidate for the IC DISC. So thus, it's probably unlikely that the CPA firm would have the luxury of having a dedicated team to address that. So we start with that one out of 200. And then of that one out of 200, most of those people have never heard of it. And the ones that have heard of it have never implemented it. In 2010, I believe it was 2010, there were only a few thousand IC DISCs in existence. And that's the last year that the IRS has shared data with that I'm aware of. And one of the reasons that the IC DISC is so underutilized is that it actually requires the formation of a separate company. And that company has to file an election, 4876A, in order to be treated like an election. Now, the CPAs are very familiar with form. I think it's 2553, the S-Corp election. But the IC DISC election is they're much stricter on that. So I mention that because that's really the first step if somebody wants an IC DISC is they need to have one set up. And that creates the first challenge is that most law firms really have no familiarity with these. And so there's just really a dearth of knowledge. So the first step is to form the IC DISC. And we help our clients with that by partnering with a number of different law firms that have expertise in that area.
So David, let's go back maybe even then a little bit further, because clearly there's some structure that needs to be established here for all of this to work. I can understand why that might be an impediment to a firm deciding to implement that. But let's step back a little bit further even from there and qualify. I am the client of a mid-size accounting firm in Houston or in Savannah or wherever, and I've got export activities that I'm undertaking. What has to exist for me to even be a candidate for this program? What's the profile that a CPA would be looking for to say, you know what, I think this is a discussion we ought to at least explore?
So that's a great question. And really, I would just start with the question that we encourage the RCPA firms that we have a good working relationship with. And that's just ask every corporate client every year, did any of your product end up outside of the US last year? And if the company sells a physical product and that answer is, say, $2 million or more, it's usually worth looking at an IC disk. And you notice the way I phrased it, does any of it end up outside the US? And that's because there's actually two types of exports. There's what's called a direct export that's what people think of as an export, where you have a client in Mexico and you sell them widgets, obvious export. But the other type is what's called an indirect export. And believe it or not, this is what most of our clients qualify under, and they don't even think of themselves as an exporting firm. And the way that works, I'll give you a good example in Houston, in the energy capital of the world. We have a lot of clients who make high quality, mission critical components for the oil and gas industry. And so they will make a product and they will sell it to a company in Houston, like a Halliburton, a Baker Hughes, somebody like that. Mm-hmm. And then they in turn will send that to a drilling rig, you know, somewhere in the world. So that product actually counts as an export if the ultimate destination within 1 year is outside of the U.S.
So does Halliburton need to sell that to an international partner, or are they just using it outside of the United States?
Either. Yeah, Halliburton can either resell it or use it. In theory, your resale chain could be 20 organizations long, but pragmatically speaking, to have some sense of control of it, usually Halliburton would be using it themselves on one of their projects.
So it's really about where the component is put into service within that initial year. Is that correct?
That's correct. And when you're talking about indirect exports, that is one of the challenges, is how you identify the indirect export. And one way to do it is sometimes a product will have a spec that's not used in the U.S. Maybe it's used in another part of the world that has just, you know, different whatever regulatory constraints. And so that item spec would not be like allowed to be used in the U.S. or for whatever reason it wouldn't. So that would be one way to tell. The other way to tell in this Halliburton example, a lot of times the purchase order will specifically mention like the rig that it's going to or the country it's going to. Those are some of the things you look at. But yeah, the short answer is typically it's usually easiest to quantify when it's just been one degree of separation.
And it is within a calendar year. Is that correct?
No, it's just a rolling 365 days.
Got it. Okay. So just to recap, the direct export is easy. We all get that. It got placed on a truck and shipped to Mexico or put in a container and sails over to Europe. That's easy. The indirect is a little bit harder. It could be sold to a base company, but used and placed into service overseas. And if we've got a mechanism to easily identify where those are, then those can be counted as well. And I think I heard you say that you've got to have about $2 million of sales before this starts to become appealing. Did I hear that right?
Yeah, that's about right. About $2 million of direct and indirect sales combined is where it's worth starting to look. At about $5 million, it's usually worth doing. At $10 million or more, I can't think of a situation where it did not make sense to use it.
Okay. So I'm that practitioner. I've got clients that are exporting or they're manufacturing things that are being used outside of the country. I think this might be above a $2 million revenue threshold. Is there any other criteria that I need to be aware of before I approach a client and begin the conversation?
Not really. The only other thing, I guess, to think about is that our typical client is really a unique company. Our typical client is probably $40 million in revenue and 25% exports, say $40 million in total revenue, 10 in exports. And the other unique thing about our clients is they usually don't borrow money. and there's usually no more than two shareholders. Okay. And the reason they don't borrow, and so the fact they don't borrow money is important because it means there's not a bank requiring an audit. So many of our clients actually use a sole practitioner, and they're oftentimes the largest client at that firm. And let's see, there was a reason I was going that direction. Oh, and the number of shareholders. So we find that if a company has, say, 20 shareholders, the decision-making just becomes more cumbersome. So that may be part, it may just be my impatience, maybe in the sales process, that if decisions take years to happen and there's a lot of committees, maybe I just lose interest. But we do have clients that have, I think, maybe 10 shareholders.
So if we were going to paint a target on ground zero, what I'm hearing is $40 million company with at least 25% of that being export related, a small number of owners, so closely held, not a ton of shareholders, and no debt that is triggering external requirement for an audit.
Yeah, that's about right. Now, just because clients borrow money doesn't mean they're not a good fit for it, but that just so happens to be the makeup. The other factor too is that our clients tend to be top quintile performers financially in their industry. And when you think about it, it makes sense. If a company is struggling for survival, one year they make money, one year they lose money. Tax savings is probably not their most urgent business objective. So our clients tend to be pretty predictably profitable. They tend to have been in business more than a decade, and they tend to just be very, very well-run, nicely performing companies.
So that's helpful, because if I'm a practitioner and I'm just slammed, and I know what ICDISC is, and I think it applies to exporting, and I really don't have a deep understanding, you've just given me the profile for what I'm looking for. And if I've got one or two clients, and maybe that's it, one or two clients that fall into those categories, it sounds like that's a conversation I need to be having with them for a couple of reasons. First of all, it's good advice. It makes sense. Yes, I check the box that I'm being more advisory oriented. But B, I would hate one of my competitors to identify client as a potential target for this, and all of a sudden my competitors having this conversation with my clients.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. And that brings up another dynamic that we see, that as a former CPA, it always makes me sad. Probably 90% of the clients who come to us are not referred by the CPA. And I never enjoy that conversation when the client says, geez, how long has this program been around? And I have to say 51 years. And they say, wow, we've had the same CPA for 30 years. Does that mean they dropped the ball? And I hate that question, because my answer is always going to be, no, not at all. It's very specialized. Your CPA has to have a working knowledge of lots of different things. It's very niche. You're probably the only client that qualifies. No, I would not say they dropped the ball. But it does make me sad, because what ends up happening is that either another client of ours referred us to them, or their banker referred them, or their golfing buddy. And so the sad part is just the CPA could have enjoyed the kind of intellectual benefit of that introduction. And our typical client is saving six figures a year in taxes from the DISC. And most of our clients pay less than six figures in CPA fees each year. So you could argue that if the CPA had identified the opportunity, made the introduction, in essence, they've just paid for themselves like for all eternity just through that one incentive.
Yeah, it's interesting, because again, I don't want to give them the excuse that they're just too busy to take the time, but the political climate and the tax climate right now is compelling them just to focus on compliance and meeting deadlines. And meanwhile, stuff goes unexplored and unexamined. We've got to connect the dots. And so having you provide that profile is pretty helpful. Let's go back then and pick up the conversation where we detoured previously. You mentioned that you work with a number of law firms that specialize in this discipline. There is meant to set up a separate entity. Without getting down into the weeds, just kind of through the structure of how this is set up and what needs to be done to generate that $100,000 plus in tax savings that your average client is experiencing.
Sure. So the setup fee is usually around $7,500. It really starts off just like any other corporation. There's a initial filing with the Secretary of State of whatever state you're going to do the work in. Most of our clients are in either Delaware or Texas. Delaware, obviously, Texas, partially because it's where we're headquartered and partially because there are no annual filing fees or any taxes due from the DISC being in Texas. And since we're here, we just let them use our office address as the official address of the DISC. So we can just manage all that, any correspondence. And then really the only other two pieces is that when you file the, when you incorporate the DISC, you have a very strict deadline to be able that you have to file the election to be treated as an IC DISC. And that election is called Form 4876A. And again, I mentioned it's like the 2553. And, you know, I am just suddenly blanking. You have either 60 or 90 days. A lot of the DISC deadlines are either 60 or 90. And because I don't usually get involved in filing that, I'm drawing a blank. It's either 60 or 90 days. I'm pretty sure it's 90 days to file that. So that's one way that it's different than an S corp. My understanding with an S corp is you really have up until you file the initial tax return to provide the Form 2553, and you can even just attach it to the return. The 4876A is very different. There is a firm deadline, and if you miss it, you cannot use the DISC for that year. And then the other piece is the legal documents between the operating company and the DISC. There's some specific rules on what's called the sales agent agreement between the operating company and the DISC. And this is where having an attorney who's done this quite a bit is helpful, because it just ensures all the I's get dotted and the T's get crossed. The other thing different about the DISC, there's this concept of form over function, where if an entity doesn't serve a business purpose, that you run the risk of being disallowed by the service. The DISC is the exact opposite. The IRS actually relaxes the form over function rules, and there are no employees, there's no physical location, there's no business purpose for the IC DISC. But so that's the good news, is they relax those rules. But the bad news, they compensate it by the rules they do have are really rigid and really strict. So one has to be careful that they don't miss those types of deadlines and other specific details.
So it really behooves me as a practitioner to be working with a third party that has the expertise. You, in terms of the structure and the setup, the law firm in terms of company and things like that. I'm guessing most accounting firms might have a handful of clients that would qualify. As you said earlier in the podcast, and I tend to agree, the likelihood that I've got deep technical expertise in this area in-house is pretty thin. And it sounds like you really have to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed to make sure the client's best interests are served.
Yeah, we think so. We manage over 400 DISCs, and this is all we do. And we find that specialization is very useful because it is such a niche. And the other challenge is, one of the jokes we have is nobody makes partner being the IC DISC expert at the firm, because it's just really any niche market, any niche space like that. So it really just, it creates a perfect storm where, and this may shock you, but we have worked with clients with every one of the top 10 largest CPA firms, including the big four. In every one of those firms, we have taken over work because the CPA firm completely screwed it up. And we're talking big four firms here. And so my point, when I'm talking to a local firm, even a regional firm, I say, look, the big four struggles to get this right. That should maybe tell you something. And the reason is because it's the same thing. There's a tax form and it's included in the tax software. And so you just have your staff tax person say, oh yeah, and this client has a DISC. The returns are real short. The instructions are only 6 pages long. How hard can it be? But there's just a lot of nuance that just is not obvious if somebody hasn't worked with it.
So talk a little bit about the relationship you have with a CPA firm. Obviously, you're not interested in coming in and doing their tax returns or stealing their audit. It seems like you're almost positioned as an adjunct to their staff that has narrowly defined technical expertise that can be called upon on an as-needed basis. Not a lot of risk if I'm a partner in an accounting firm. I've got this nice annuity, a client that comes back to me every year. Maybe I do the tax returns. Perhaps we're doing some kind of assurance. I don't have to worry about you coming in and poaching my client.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And not only are we not a competitor, we don't want to be a competitor. And so I tell my team, we have three people we serve and each have a different need. We have the owner of the business. And I tell my team, you have to remember, this is a brilliant entrepreneur. Tax is not their experience. And every year, we will need to re-educate the entrepreneur on how it works. And that's perfectly fine. Then we have the CFO, who we view as like, you know, just an incredibly hardworking, overworked, overwhelmed person who has to keep up with so many different things. And so we want to make their life easy by minimizing the document request from them. And then we have the CPA, who we say is like this brilliant person who has to have a working knowledge of literally thousands of different parts of the tax code when you think federal, county, city, state, and that we serve them by being useful and taking up very little of their time and just staying in our lane and just doing what we can and answering their questions as we go along.
Okay. Talk a little bit then, what, because the accounting firm is going to want to know what the fee arrangement looks like. Maybe just talk in broad brush strokes how this, that's something that is structured. Is it a percentage of what you're able to move into the DISC category? How does the client pay for your services?
Sure. So we've got, I hate to give you the standard, it depends on the circumstances. It does. It depends on the number of all kinds of things. But in general, we have two general fee structures. One is just a fixed fee. The other is just a percentage of the ICDISC commission amount that was paid from the operating company to the ICDISC. And we're happy to do it either way. Oftentimes in the first year, they will want it to do it on that percentage of the commission amount because they're more skeptical. Because the other thing about the DISC that I didn't touch on is you only get the benefit from the date of incorporation forward. And so it's one of the few tax incentives I'm aware of that you don't have the luxury of waiting till the end of the year to see if you want to use it. And so it creates a situation that on January 1, most businesses we work with, they can't tell you on January 1 what their exports are going to be, what their revenues and what their profits are going to be at the end of the year. Because, right, who knows? And it just seems like volatility just continues to get amped up in the economic aspect of our world. There's this really a disincentive to set up a DISC because all you know for sure is that you're going to be out $7,500 and you may or may not even save that much in taxes depending on how your year works out. So that's part of the structure. And so we actually have one fee scenario where we'll actually absorb that $7,500 fee and just charge them just a percentage of the commission amount to try to reduce the risk as the financial risk as much as possible.
And then if an accounting firm refers a client to you, is there a way for them to participate either in that fee or is there additional work that they are now able to do as a result of establishing?
Sure.
Is there a financial win?
Yeah, the short answer is absolutely. We're happy to make it economically attractive for anybody who refers us work, be it a CPA, an attorney, a banker, another client, a wealth advisor. Sometimes the professional rules of certain industries impact what we can and cannot do. But in general, we have found that with a CPA firm, what's the simplest is if we just pay them a flat, what we would call a review fee, for them to review things and make sure everything ties together. We don't, practically speaking, it really only takes the CPA really just 2 minutes. The process, we get the final draft corporate return, we get some data from the client, we do our work, and then they pull two numbers from the DISC return and update the S-Corp or partnership return. So really, it doesn't take very much time. But I suppose if the CPA wanted to really feel highly confident and they really wanted to dig into things, because our average return is probably 300 pages long. So I suppose if the CPA really wanted to drill into that, that could take quite a bit of time. And so that could potentially justify the, quote, review fee.
Okay. So there's an economic reason for them to do this in addition to just, this is what I'm called to do as a practitioner, bringing these things to the attention of my clients where it's appropriate to do.
Absolutely.
So really no reason not to be engaged with this. Tell me, I know you've got some resources out there that are pretty substantive. The two I wanted to explore with you, the first one is you've got an ebook. I think it's available via Amazon called Is an IC Disc Right for Me? The Entrepreneur's Guide to Evaluating the IC Disc. Tell me a little bit about that resource and where I can get that.
Yeah. So yeah, it is available on Amazon, the actual hard book, and we have actual physical copies for in-person meetings. And then the ebook, I haven't looked at it in a while. I believe it's on our website at exportadvisors.com under resources. Yeah, here it is. It's right here. We have the book there and then a couple other downloads and educational items. And that was written really for the entrepreneur. It's a short book. It's written at a very high level. And yeah, that's the purpose of the book.
Okay. So if I wanted to get a 10,000 foot understanding of this, that would be a good resource for me to start. And then tell me about the IC Disc Show. I know you're in podcast business like I am. It sounds like that's been pretty successful for you.
Yeah, it has been. I just realized something I neglected to mention that's very important. So if you don't mind, let me take it, my second detour and answer that afterwards. Do you mind if I take
No, not detour? At all. That's
okay.
Perfect.
So the IC Disc return, so there's two ways to do what's called the IC Disc commission calculation. So there's the easy way and the hard way. And the easy way takes 5 minutes by the client to get us the data we need. All they have to give us is what their total exports were for the year. And then we get a copy of the draft corporate return. And that's all you need to do what we call a simple calculation or a standard calculation. And 99% of the returns we see are done this way. The return is about 8 or 9 pages long. And it's very straightforward. You multiply the export sales by 4% or the export income by 50%, whichever's highest, that's the amount that's paid to the IC Disc. Now, Okay. And people always ask, why would we want to do it the hard way? So the hard way on average triples the benefit. And the reason it does is we actually are able to use 18 different calculation options for every single line item for every sale they made for through the entire year. And the impact of that is twofold. One is on average, it triples the benefit. And two, instead of a 10-page return, you end up with a return that's hundreds of pages long. And the reason I just wanted to mention this, because we also frequently will see that CPAs may have one or two DISC clients and they're doing the DISC return. And they say, no, we don't need your help at all. These are real straightforward. It only takes 10 minutes to do it. And the thing I'll mention is I'll say, you probably don't even know, but there's another way to do the calculation called a transaction by transaction calculation. And it results in a much larger benefit. Now, the drawback to that is it's almost impossible to do that without specialized software. So you can't just use the standard IC Disc software. And it's also very difficult to do if you don't have a deep understanding of the 18 calculation options available for each transaction. And to be honest, this is really where our value comes in. If somebody really just needs a simple calculation and there's really no benefit from the T by T, the transaction by transaction, then our value is really not as great. Our value really comes in because of our financial and time commitment to really knowing this at just the deepest level. So I did want to just mention that because there is a difference. Not all IC discalculations are the same. And I'll bet you, in even the big four firms, I would say 95% of the calculations we see done by big four firms are a simple calculation, and they've captured only a fraction of what they could have.
It's interesting. That really mirrors what we see in our core business on credit. There's a lot of, hey, get your credit online and the algorithm will calculate it, or we're just going to take some very high level numbers and draw some conclusions. We see the same thing. Like when you really get somebody who's expert involved and has the necessary tools to do a thorough analysis, the benefit is almost in every instance significantly greater than what was originally on the table. So it sounds like you guys follow that trajectory as well.
I think that's a great parallel example.
Okay, so let's come back. Tell me more about IC Disc Show. Where can I get that podcast and what can I expect to hear?
So the website is icdiscshow.com. That's with the hyphen icdiscshow.com. You can also find it on any of the major forums. The easiest way is probably just search by my full name, David Spray. I have two different podcasts, and you'll be able to see the IC Disc Show. I haven't checked lately, but if you also just type in just IC-Disc, it'll pop up, but it may be one of many entries because anybody who ever had a show that had a topic talking about IC Disc would show up in that search.
Okay, fantastic. And then if I want to visit your website, that is just at exportadvisors.com, just all together one word.
That is correct. And then the other website that's just about to go live, in the last year, I created something called the IC Disc Alliance, where I could bring best of breed folks who really specialize in the IC Disc together in one platform. And that website is just icdisc.com with the hyphen ic-disc.com. And that's the website for the IC Disc Alliance. It has some additional resources. But in the easiest one is just exportadvisors.com. But I suppose either one will work.
And if I wanted to reach out to you, David, what's the best way to do that? Obviously, we'll have your website address and your email in the description of the podcast. But if I wanted to reach out, is email best through the website? What's the easiest way for me to get in touch with you?
Yeah, email is probably the easiest. And they could just go to info@ic-disc.com or my email address, dspray@exportadvisors.com. I'm also on LinkedIn. I'm not super active, but they could find me there as well.
Sounds great. David, thanks so much for spending the time with us today. I think you've done a fantastic job painting the picture for where this makes sense, talking a little bit about the technical nature of how what it takes to set this up appropriately. And I think our audience would be very appreciative for the education and knowledge that you passed along in the podcast. So thanks for being here.
Yeah, my pleasure. And the only thing I would add to the practitioners there is all day long, I field phone calls from potential clients, CPA firms, other advisors. I love to do it, and it's never a bother. And really, the first step for anybody who thinks they might have a fit is just reach out to me. My mobile number is 832-654-9889, 832-654-9889. And just give me a call, and in just a 5 or 10 minute conversation with the client being anonymous, I'll have a pretty good sense of whether we can help or not. So they should never feel bashful to follow up. And we're plenty busy, so I'm not going to hound them for the rest of their life to asking them whatever happened to that one prospect.
Sounds good, and I know that's appreciated. There he is, everybody. David Spray, the president of Export Advisors. I want to thank him for joining us on today's podcast, and hopefully you found it helpful as you start to think about being more advisory-minded in your public accounting practice. Take care, everybody.
And there we have it, another episode focused on helping our CPA listeners accelerate their firm's advisory practice. The Advisory Accelerator podcast is sponsored by the Engineered Advisory family of companies, Engineered Tax Services, The Growth Partnership, Able CRM, and Inside Public Accounting. Learn more about how we help CPAs accelerate their advisory practices at engineeredadvisory.com. Until next time, this is Jeff Paulo signing off and wishing you nothing but success as you transition your firm from compliance to advisory.